Hello, and welcome to New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, campaigners from all over Africa will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences that are too often missed by mainstream media. How China takes Africa with money, not guns. Why international alliances are planning against privatisation. And what the world will look like in 20 years' time. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine, and I'm joined today by Adam Marnett and Jess Worth, also co-editors with New Internationalist magazine. Jess and Adam are in Nairobi, Kenya, at a World Social Forum held in the third week of January this year. Organisers were expecting 150,000 participants from more than 100 countries. What's a day in the life of an African social forum look like, Jess?
It looks completely crazy. You get up painfully early in the morning because the first session starts at 8:30, but it takes a long time to get here because the Nairobi traffic is so hectic and there's gridlock everywhere. So that's your first challenge, is actually get to the stadium where the forum's being held, because it's about 10 kilometres out of town. Then the day is just completely packed. The programme is hundreds of pages long, and there are hundreds and hundreds of different sessions that you can go to, organized in four blocks a day of 2.5 hours. So you could find yourself spending a 12-hour day just in meetings. And the meetings are on everything that you could imagine to do with the struggles of people around the world and the alternatives that social movements are advocating for. You know, everything from debt to Western Sahara people's rights, you know, and everything in between.
Just take us into one of those meeting rooms. For a start, what language are people speaking? And can they understand each other?
Well, that brings us on to another interesting dimension of the forum. I mean, it contains people from all over the world, and that's really wonderful. But technically, there have been an awful lot of problems. So in theory, translation services are available, where a translator just talks quietly into a microphone while the speaker is speaking, and whoever needs a translation listens to it. But in practice, often there haven't even been microphones for the speakers. They've just had shouts over the noise. I don't know where the microphones went. I think they probably got nicked. So that's one challenge. And most meetings are in English by default. Some are in French, some are in Spanish. But it's quite difficult, actually, for people who don't speak English. The first couple of days, there were power cuts all the time. And in the last session I was in on the first day, all the power went at about 6 o'clock in the evening with 2 hours to go. So as it got dark, people were having to shout because there were no microphones, but also they couldn't see each other because there were no lights. So we were having these intense meetings in the pitch black. You know, it doesn't take anything away from the spirit and the energy and the kind of inspiration of this event. I mean, it's just full of people who are changing the world at international levels, and everybody is kind of celebrating everybody else's struggles and achievements. There's just this wonderful sense of solidarity between people, but also there are lots of marches taking place around the stadium because it's circular. Everything from Sudanese workers chanting "Go away Bush, go away Blair, we want peace," to street children, to Brazilian dancers. There's so many of them that they're starting to meet each other coming the other way. Then there's this huge burst of joy and hugs and hooray, and then they kind of try and filter past each other and then carry on going.
So all the issues are colliding, actually, practically.
Exactly.
Well, World Social Forums organise under the banner Another World is Possible. The question is, what is that other world? Let's talk now with Pat Mooney from the What Next project. On current trends, what's the world likely to look like in 30 years' time, do you think, Pat?
Well, it's not an optimistic look if we follow the trend line. If there's other possibilities for certain, another world is possible, but we had about 65 people who spent a few years arguing back and forth on what was most likely to happen unless we change our practices as civil society, as well as civil society changing governments. And what we basically came down to, I think they can simply describe, is that we'll continue to see a declining environment in all respects, in terms of the stratosphere, in terms of climate change, of course, in terms of biodiversity declining, genetic diversity declining, health declining, and cultural diversity declining, which is very worrisome. And while that decline takes place, governments will say to us that the only solution to saving the planet, in a sense, is if we take on new technologies, new geoengineering technologies that could profoundly and rapidly change our climate so we can survive global warming. And in some of the new technologies that are developed, because they are so dangerous, such as nuclear power, but also nanotechnology, corporations will ask the governments to protect them from liability problems. And
yes.
That's also to us a huge risk.
In my country, Australia, the chairperson of Shell has been in the country recently actually saying governments must do something about climate change, and then 2 weeks later making evident that he was very supportive of nuclear power for an option for Australia. Politicians are leaning toward that option now. What do you see as being the take-up rate on that particular issue? There seems to be a lot of people who are talking about it at the moment.
Yeah, it certainly is. There's dozens, literally dozens, perhaps even closer to 100, and, you know, at least on paper, if not in construction, new nuclear power plants around the world. And many more governments are talking about the need, regrettably, to go in that direction. Frankly, we, in looking at the trend line scenario for the next 30 years, when we saw that happening, we actually saw that, because it would be very divisive for many societies, that what governments would do is more experiments in terms of polluting the stratosphere to deflect sunlight. And while that seems crazy, it's actually a serious conversation in places like the White House and the major institutions in the United States and Western Europe. They also are saying that there are these new nanotechnologies that actually could be used for changing the ocean surface to mitigate against both temperature change and at the same time against hurricanes, which is near and dear to the heart of the United States especially.
Absolutely. Katrina, yes. I'm wondering, with nanotechnology, for those of us who don't know very much about it, Pat, could you just run through what the technologies involve and why they might be of concern?
Sure. In very short form, nanotech is really working at the level of atoms and molecules. The concept is you can move down from the control, for example, of agriculture, from seeds down to genes with biotechnology, down to atoms with nanotechnology. But at the atomic scale, of course, of the periodic table, we're talking about all life, both natural living materials and natural non-living materials. And that's the power grab that companies are trying to make with nanotechnology, that they really can operate at this sort of atomic level to build things and to make, they would argue, energy-efficient, better health systems, better recycling systems, and so on than we have at this time. And they also, of course, see it as their best route to trying what they know will be seen as very risky in terms of geoengineering. Probably the best way to summarize how fast this is moving is to say that last year, industry and governments together spent $10 billion U.S. on basic research in nanotechnology, and that's greater than the amount of money that was invested by the U.S. on an annual basis, for example, on the Manhattan Project or in putting someone on the moon. So it's a huge investment in current dollars. Their estimate by the U.S. government is that by the year 2015, the global market value of nanotech will be $2.6 trillion. But that's about 15% of the world economy, and it's about 10 times the market value of biotechnology. It's equal to the total market value of telecommunications and informatics industries now. It's so fundamental. The building blocks for nanotechnology are the atom. It really cuts across every technology. You see patents that have been granted in the United States that actually touch upon the use of 33 different elements in the periodic table. That's more than a third of the really functional, useful elements in the periodic table. You also see patents being granted where, in fact, the company says, well, the patent is basically for electrical purposes of some kind, but in fact, it can be used in the pharmaceutical industry, the food and beverage industry, the aerospace industry, and the computer industry. Because, again, everything is made up of atoms and molecules, So if you can get fundamental patents in this field, you get everything.
So we're talking about transnationals taking ownership of the building blocks of everything in the world, essentially, are we?
Exactly. Exactly that.
Yes. And so this burgeoning reliance on nanotechnology, Paint a picture for us, Pat. We've got certainly a reliance and a transnational-led ownership of the basic building blocks. What do you see as the problems associated with that, you know, in a fundamental way?
Well, one, of course, is the companies have moved way too fast, and governments are embarrassed by this as well, which gives us some opportunities, in fact, to fight back. There are hundreds of products in the marketplace today that are based on nanotechnology. There are pesticides, there are food products, there's cosmetics and sunscreens and so on that are being used literally on a daily basis. And there are no regulations that deal with nanotechnology in any country except for in one small court area related to pesticides in the United States. And even that's just brand new. So governments are embarrassed by this, and they're trying to figure out what to do about the embarrassment that people are eating stuff and they don't know whether it's safe or not. The big thing, perhaps, I haven't described about nanotechnology, besides this idea of controlling the elements of the periodic table, in a sense, is that when you move down into the nanoscale, below, you know, from the macro to the micro to the nano, the characteristics of elements of the periodic table change dramatically. For example, aluminum oxide that dentists use to repair teeth, very benign, very safe, that's why it's used. At the nanoscale, the U.S. Air Force uses it to ignite bombs, because its characteristics, again, are entirely different. It's highly explosive. Same is true with gold. If you've got a ring on your fingers, it's gold. It's bright and yellow. At the nanoscale, it's red. At a certain scale in the nano range, it's actually highly reactive. So this industry wants to exploit. For them, it means multiplying the periodic tables that are available to them. That means that they can actually multi-source their raw materials and perhaps dramatically reduce their dependence upon major raw material suppliers, both in agriculture and in mining. That's extremely attractive to companies.
I can imagine it would be. So you're saying essentially that the periodic tables are becoming more unstable, or certainly the change of characteristics is happening, but what's the effect of that?
The effect is a certain sense of panic. We see, for example, in the U.S. National Science Foundation and at the White House, there are working groups that are looking at how do you prevent hurricanes from hitting the United States? How do you divert them further south, or how do you cool the Sargasso Sea in such a way that the hurricane temperature will drop and so they won't be effective in hitting the United States? And I think we can probably imagine that the White House is quite prepared to take a risk on someone else's climate as long as they can protect Miami from disappearing someday.
Mm.
So that is a certain panic to the scenario. Governments do realize that the Kyoto Accord will not work, that it is a failure. They do realize that carbon trading is a joke and is not going to reduce CO2 emissions. And they are now saying we have to leave open the possibility that we do these kinds of extreme engineering strategies that are now possible because we can work at the nanoscale and manipulate ocean surfaces or the stratosphere.
Your work outlines some much more positive futures, though. What does the world have to do to get a better prognosis, Pat?
Well, our focus was primarily on civil society, really on social movements and NGOs who do work together now. And, of course, I'm at the World Social Forum where people, the whole thing is working together. How do we network and cooperate and learn from each other? And we've developed three scenarios, which I think for some readers might be disappointing, because over the next 30 years, nirvana doesn't happen. Some religious leader doesn't show us the true faith. We don't suddenly solve all of our problems of peace and justice. But there are modest changes that turn the downward trend upward again, that make it possible. One of them is a trend that looks at working at the United Nations and civil society, really getting in and playing with the mechanisms of the UN in such a way that we really influence the secretariat structures, the sort of leadership of UN agencies in a way that really can, I believe, make some difference in terms of what is put on the agenda of the UN system and how it's moved through the UN system. That's a modest proposal, without question. A second proposal is that we could look at ways in which the social forum itself could be more coordinated in terms of peace and disarmament issues, which is a common thread throughout all of the social forums, and that we might be more proactive in throwing the weight of hundreds of thousands of people who come to social forums behind that move and really embarrassing governments into acting. The third scenario we looked at, and the one perhaps I'm most enthusiastic about, is one in which on the periphery of the big metropolitan powers and the rural communities up and down the mountains and hillsides of the world, the marginalized farmers and the communities that live even within cities that are marginalized start to cooperate together, both on sort of food issues and seed issues, but also on water, on education, on municipal organization, and sort of low-level, local-level democracy in a way that these movements, which are very strong and evident here in the social forum, really come together as a concerted action. in a region of a country and within the country and at the global level actually start to make changes and fight economic globalization.
Pat Mooney, thanks very much for joining us today. That was Pat Mooney from the What Next Project. And Pat, can you tell us what a website address might be for anybody who wants to follow up on some of the very many interesting things that you've been talking about just now?
Sure. It's ETC Group, all one word, ETCGROUP.org.
Good on you, Pat. Thank you very much. I'm Chris Richards, and you're listening to New Internationalist, broadcast on community radio stations around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And today, progressive people at this year's World Social Forum in Kenya are calling in for a chat. The World Social Forum is run as a counterbalance to the World Economic Forum, a yearly meeting held in the Swiss resort town of Davos, where you'll find the world's business and political elite. Broadly speaking, the social forums bring together different groups, mainly from civil society, who oppose global domination by capital. They aim to place social and environmental justice, international solidarity, peace and gender equality on both political and media agendas. But not all civil society groups in Kenya support how the forum has been run. On Monday and Tuesday, protesters clashed with organisers. New Internationalist's Adam Marnett is at the forum. Tell us what happened, Adam.
Well, it was one of those kinds of things that you probably wouldn't expect at the World Social Forum, but actually in a way you would, because this is the kind of thing we're all about and what presumably the World Social Forum is about. Essentially, we had a number of participants disagreeing with the way the World Social Forum was organised. There was a lot of dubious sponsorship by corporations. There was a lot of complaints about the fees that were charged to Kenyans and other African participants, which were very exorbitant, and also the food prices and so on. And so this led to a number of the Kenyan activists, many of whom live in the nearby slums, to organize and protest against the World Social Forum's policies. The brilliant thing is that this has actually been very effective. They did two things. They managed to get the organizers to agree to many of their demands. Now Kenyan participants from the slums can actually attend free of charge. And there's already a feeling of openness within the forum and a new vitality that hasn't been there before. Mm. As well, there's also been this general sense that, the slogan of the World Social Forum is Another World is Possible. And I think the actions of the Kenyans in particular in the last few days has proven that it is indeed true, that if we do take collective action, we can change things, and we see that here today.
Let's go back to the reasons why this protest happened. You said that one of the reasons was the face of the forum, the fact that there was so much corporate sponsorship. What were you seeing, Adam? What type of corporate sponsorship was there?
Well, probably the most visible corporate sponsor is Celtel, which is the network I'm speaking to you from. Celtel is the dominant mobile telecommunications operator in Africa. It used to be an African corporation. It's since been sold to a Kuwaiti operation. And, there's a number of sort of monopoly-like arrangements that have been made with the World Social Forum such that other mobile phone operators can't sell and tout their services here within the forum space. A vast sum of money has been paid to the World Social Forum, and there's been questions about where this money is going to and why are we charging exorbitant fees for Kenyans and then making all these deals with these companies. Kenya Airways is another one of the sponsors. Kenya Airways at the moment has been denying the rights of its workers to form a union. And
oh, good World Social Forum participants, aren't they?
Yeah, and many of the World Social Forum participants are committed labor and union rights activists.
Yeah, of course.
So this does smell a bit of hypocrisy here. Millions of Kenyan shillings have been made in deals with these corporations, and then Kenyan participants from the slums are still having to pay exorbitant fees to enter, people were wondering, well, what's the benefit of these deals if this money is changing hands, but we're seeing very little of it here in the Social Forum? I mean, if CELTOL makes a deal with the World Social Forum, we expect to have at least reliable internet access. We don't even have that. So, but I mean, essentially what the Kenyan organizers were saying was, this is the World Social Forum. This is not the World Economic Forum. And these kinds of deals with corporations are run counter to the spirit of the World Social Forum.
Absolutely.
And they should be opposed.
One of the things that I can imagine people are asking, too, is into what pockets is this money going? There's a smell of corruption perhaps in the air, Adam?
There certainly is a worry by the Kenyan protesters that there is some degree of corruption going on here.
I mean, it's extraordinary at a World Social Forum, which is about bringing the majority world into the world stage, that people who are the most affected, supposedly, by the issues being discussed at the World Forum are actually discouraged from coming through the prices that are being charged both for entry and food.
There's a million living just nearby in the outskirts of Nairobi. So this led to slum dwellers having what they call the alternative social forum. They've been doing these nightly events in the slums, and then they would end their event by coming to the social forum here in the morning and staging protests.
One of the criticisms of these forums is that they don't challenge the existing capitalist power structure and effectively keep in place unfair political and economic structures that disadvantage the majority world. In this way, they actually help keep another world from happening. What do you reckon, Adam, about that criticism?
Well, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot of problems, but I also do feel like it's still an amazing space. And the fact that, you know, the change did happen, you know, the protests were successful, and now there's a real new sense of enthusiasm, exuberance, and a kind of injection of vitality in the World Social Forum process that really was sort of lacking in the last few days. And now this is where all the really exciting stuff is happening, and now there's a lot more of a kind of genuine interaction between people. And I've been seeing this throughout in various workshops where there's just a bit more of an animated debate going on, and people are really feeling like, sort of, first of all, deconstructing what is this World Social Forum thing about, what is it for, where is it going, and do we need to maybe question some of its basic assumptions and change things and to ensure that this continues in a positive way. And then there's also the real work on the ground, which is the basic issues that people are fighting for or against and struggling in their various countries, and finding other people struggling in similar issues, making those connections, building up friendships and relationships, and making action plans to take forward after the forum. That's what the World Social Forum is really all about.
Yes. Fascinating stuff, Adam. Thanks for talking to us, and thanks for taking some time off from the World Social Forum to be part of this program.
My pleasure.
That was Adam Marnett, co-editor of New Internationalist magazine. And as he was explaining, some important alliances are being made at this forum in a range of issues, including HIV/AIDS, the landless, peace and conflict, youth, debt, free trade agreements, labour, housing, privatisation, and female genital mutilation. The World Health Organization estimates that between 100 to 140 million women have undergone some form of female genital mutilation. Basila Urasa is the executive coordinator of the Network Against Female Genital Mutilation from Tanzania. Basila, can we start our conversation today by asking you to outline what the extent of the problem about female genital mutilation is in Africa at the moment?
Well, very briefly, unfortunately, female genital mutilation, which is normally referred to as FGM, is one of the worst forms of violence against women. It is also one of the worst but least realized forms of human rights abuses in the world. It is practiced in many countries in Africa, particularly those south of the Sahara, from Tanzania, Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, and also in West Africa, and I understand also in some parts of Asia.
It must be a very challenging role in front of you at the moment. How do you actually move societies that are culturally bound to female genital mutilation out of that space and into some other positive space that realises this type of mutilation is an assault on women?
A lot of things people do, they do them not because they are bad, not because they want to hurt the people, but purely out of ignorance. They don't know better. So what we try to do is really to give communities space to re-examine their situations. We give them space, we give them an opportunity to get the necessary information. And in our experience, that has been our most area of success. People have now come to understand that this particular practice is really no good to them. No parent, for instance, would like to cut up his daughter. But they do that purely, in my view, out of ignorance more than anything else.
Mm. Basila, can you give us an example of perhaps an area that you've worked where you've seen a change of attitude and how that came about?
Well, there is a huge change of attitude. For instance, when we started our activities in 1999, and at that time, officially, the figures for FGM in Kilimanjaro region were supposed to be something above 37%. As I talk to you now, the official figure has come down to 20%.
Oh, that's amazing.
Now, this has really been, I can attribute that to the methods we use. We empower people, we empower women, we empower men, because this is not just a culture which affects women. It affects also men, but men don't know. They're the ones who demand it of the women. You cannot get married if you are not cut. So we empower the old women who cut up the women, the circumcisers. We empower children so that they know what this practice is all about. Because normally, in Africa, sexual matters are taboo. We don't talk about them. So we try from the very beginning to empower young girls, young boys, to understand what this culture is about. Children know about FGM when it was already too late, when they are already cut. We involve religious organizations. We involve schools. We involve women groups, anybody.
I'm just wondering how you empower a child to say no. I mean, the cultural forces on that child must be extremely weighty. How does a child then turn around and say, I'm not going to have this procedure?
Well, for a child, it is pretty difficult. But because we do not take our activities in singly, it is a whole... It is all related. Every member of society must get the information. So the child, if she gets the information, say in school, we know when she gets home, she will talk to the mother. And the mother will talk to somebody else. So the information passes on. But there are also cases where the child, after getting the information about the harmful effect of FGM, may find herself threatened in the home that she's going to be mutilated and she has got to run away. So by empowering institutions, the community institutions, the cultural institutions, which are already positive about FGM elimination, these children have some kind of safety nets. But unfortunately, these safety nets are not very well developed in Tanzania, and by safety nets, I mean safe homes.
Right.
If I understand that my neighbor's daughter is going to be mutilated and I can save her, that's also my responsibility.
Yes, yes. And I suppose that the context in which you're talking about requires political will, doesn't it? It requires that governments and their public service institutions are actually behind you and your organisation in saying, no, this is no longer acceptable. We're moving past this. There must be countries in Africa that are fully behind you, but there must also be countries in Africa that aren't. What are the challenges in terms of countries that you face at the moment, Basila?
Well, on the national level, most of our countries like Tanzania, they have passed a law against the FGM. The law in Tanzania concerns only children under 18, but we are in the process of negotiating with the government for the repeal of that law. It should be inclusive. There should be no age put on it. We have, as I say, also an activity which we train, we as an organization, we try to sensitize the lawmakers, the parliamentarians. We go there, we train the magistrates, we train the police. Like last year, we trained 2,500 policemen. And a lot of these men, they know we have this tradition, but actually what is done, they don't know. They only demand it. So we come out, we're very open, we show them, we use what we call an atomic model to show the men what exactly is cut in a woman, how it is done and everything. And this is a very powerful a method of sensitizing people, so they know. Even for the women who have been cut, they have no idea how it was done.
Yes.
So we use every kind of method to sensitize everybody.
Yes, I can imagine some of that actually showing people how it's done would be very powerful, because infibulation, which is a procedure where the tissue around the vagina is sewn shut, leaving only a small opening for the passage of urine and menstrual blood, still takes up about 15% of the 2 million odd female genital mutilation cases around the world every year. I mean, that is a very extreme procedure for women to undergo, isn't it?
And if I may interrupt there, I must also tell you one thing which is very, very important. The women who do the cutting, the circumcisers, they actually believe they are doing a service to the community, just like what a doctor does in doing surgery on you. So when we train them to understand that this is not right, they are the ones who really now, they're one of the most important supporters against FGM.
Priscilla, but why would they think that? Why would they think that they're doing a service to the community?
Because the society requires women to be mutilated. Somebody is going to do it. And these are the ones who do it. So they are providing...
Yes.
But they regard it as a service. And we in Tanzania, what we have done, we've tried to give them an alternative. Because when they do the mutilations, they also get some sort of a reward. So we have, and these same women, they are also acting as traditional birth attendants in the villages. So we take that opportunity to give them an alternative. We try to give them training in consultation with the Ministry of Health so that they can do this other part of the service, the birth attendance work, in a better, more hygienic, because we have no quarrel with that. They are still needed in that area. And that also makes sure that their status in society is not jeopardized. We're not there as witch hunters.
I'm just wondering, though,
I don't know if you...
going back to the question about a service to the community, what is the feeling culturally in Africa that supports this?
The main reason for the mutilation is that it controls women's sexuality. Women are not supposed to enjoy sex. They are supposed to be cut so that they do not go after men, they do not demand sex, and so on. They also, some tribes believe the sexual organs of a woman are not that pretty, they must be cut. There are also those who believe mutilation is required by religion, particularly the Muslims. There are those also who believe that it aids childbirth, that by cutting off your genitals, then when you're having a baby, it makes birth easier. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons.
So some of the men in Africa think that if they remove the sexual pleasure from women, they won't make demands on them, essentially. That's one of the reasons, is it?
Yes, that is one of the reasons. But then when we train the men also, we put the other side of the coin to show them that they are also on the losing side sexually. Because if you are having sex with a mutilated woman, it is just a one-sided thing. You are not really having maximum pleasure even yourself. And when you turn the men on that, it does work.
So you're in Nairobi at the World Social Forum at the moment, Priscilla. Are you holding workshops? Are you talking to people? What are you doing at the forum to do with your work?
Yes, I came to this workshop through the kindness of an international organization called Equality Now, which supports our work. And we have been running a number of workshops on FGM. And yesterday we had a workshop of sharing experiences between the various groups, including us from Tanzania, from Kenya, from Ethiopia, Somalia, West Africa, and so on. Those who have been funded by Equality Now, because without this organization, I'm sure we would not have had the possibility of coming to this function, because we are very, very badly off financially. We don't get any funding from the government. We don't get any funding locally. So we really depend very much on goodwill from people like yourself and other friends.
Could you tell the people who are listening to this program where they might find out more information about your organization, Basila?
Telephone 255-27-57-55652. That's better still, through the email. That is Basila Urasa. All the letters are single. Basila Urasa. BASILAURASA at yahoo.com.
Fabulous. That's great. Thank you so much, Basila. That was Basila Urasa, who's the executive coordinator of the Network Against Female Genital Mutilation.
And thank you very much, and please come to our assistance.
Sas bi ñew na ñewuma xare bi jot na demuma magal ci jot na deguma fuma dox ni naan ay valu nonga jangi nele di nongam seex rafal yer mané isa rek batil barki mam way ñonga jaar nonga daraay way baaya yaangi donu di bay may se bigi kumbu fa nga abori jal nimbalok yar mande bay bal bay bal bay bal bay bal bay bal oy jama ni ko ma jay
Tube, performed by Nuru Kane from his album Sigil. released by Riverboat Records and distributed by the World Music Network. Nuru Kane's music explores the musical influences of North and West Africa. And we're in Africa today at this year's World Social Forum in Nairobi. Internationally, water is a major issue, so it's not surprising that it's running hot at this year's World Social Forum. Al Hassan Adam is from Ghana's Coalition Against the Privatisation of Water. Al Hassan, welcome to the program, and I wonder if you could start by telling us what is the situation in Ghana with water and water privatisation?
Well, the situation in Ghana in terms of water is not that good. In the urban area, about 60% of people living in the urban centres have water. The water in the urban area is not available 24 hours.
Mm.
It's erratic. And this is due to old facilities that are breaking down very frequent and also lack of investment of the state in the water facilities. So this has really caused a lot of problems in terms of water supply. It has contributed into high incidence of waterborne diseases such as cholera and typhoid. This is just the picture in the urban centers.
That's a shocking picture.
But in rural Ghana, it's worse. You have about 50% that have access to water. And the rest, in rural Ghana, the most prevalent water-related disease is guinea worm.
Mm.
And as of now, the world record on guinea worm, Ghana is number two.
Sorry to interrupt you, Al Hassan, but could you just tell us what guinea worm does? It's an intestinal disease, isn't it?
Well, guinea worm is a waterborne disease. It's a worm that has its egg in stagnant waters. And these waters are found in the dam and ponds and some wells. If you drink water that has the egg of a guinea worm, the egg would hatch in your muscles, and then the worm will grow and grow out of your muscles. It's come through a wound, and then it forms parts. It's debilitating. It's crippled. So Ghana is second to Sudan in terms of this serious disease infestation. It's a very big problem. It's crippled people and then denies them.
It sounds incredibly painful, actually.
Absolutely. Mm. So, supposing you are a farmer, a peasant farmer as such, your tools is a cutlass and a hoe, and the only energy or means that you could use to move these tools is your arms and legs. And you have guinea worm, which can come from any part of you, from your leg and your arms. It cripples you. It means that you will not be able to go to farm. It means that your livelihood is curtailed. So this is what is happening in rural Ghana.
Yes.
You find people's livelihood curtailed because there is no good drinking water. What we are saying is that water is a very key thing if you are addressing socio-economic rights. Water rights, water access are key.
Absolutely. I'm wondering, who provides the water in Ghana at the moment?
At the moment, there is a bit of a confused system. The Ghana Water Company, which is a public company, is supposed to provide water to Ghana. But there is a consortium of a Dutch public company called Vitens, and a South African public company called Run Water, who have formed a consortium to manage Ghana water. And this consortium has taken over a privatization scheme called management contract. The World Bank insisted that Ghana Water Company should go under management contract. And a number of companies bid for that contract, and then the consortium of Vitens and Run Water won the contract. So that is where we are now.
Yes.
Water management in Ghana is in the hands of the Dutch and the South Africans.
Yes. And I'm wondering, are those companies, the type of water provision you've just described sounds completely inept. It sounds like the infrastructure of water provision is being run down, and it sounds like the water is not being cleaned to anywhere near a safe level for consumption. Is that as a result, do you think, of the privatisation process?
It actually meant that less investment in Ghana Water Company. They run down the company by de-investing in it and giving a conditionality, saying that if you don't privatize, we won't give you money. So the company was lying idle for a number of years. And then, and when we went into the debate of privatization, they still did not give any money for the running of the company. So effectively, they run down the Ghana company to make it look inefficient for the private sector to take over. Now, the private sector took over the company in June 2006. And today, January 2007, there has not been any remarkable changes in the system. And the water workers who are originally under the public utility called Ghana Water Company have been agitating the past 3 days to throw out the consortium. Their reason is that the consortium is not doing any work, is not improving water services, and they are taking huge sums of money. They are being paid $30,000 per month per person.
$30,000 a month. And who pays that money? Obviously, people in Ghana couldn't afford to pay that money. Who actually does?
As of now, what we have is that the government is subsidizing the private company. They are inefficient, but right. Government is subsidizing them. They turn around and say they are efficient, but government have to come in to cushion them and pay the difference.
You've just launched the public-public partnership to give a new choice to water provision. Tell us about that. That sounds like a very exciting venture.
We just launched what we call the African Water Network, which is going to encourage public-public partnership. What we mean is consumers and communities having a say in the water management. And we have a couple of examples that people are working with in Kenya, in Ghana, and in Senegal that we are trying to promote as an alternative to state-led water management, which are collapsing, and also the private sector-led water management, which are woefully collapsing. We want to have participatory management, participatory governance, not only going to put your ballot papers in a box and go home, but whatever concerns your life, water, electricity, you should have an immediate stake in it and the voice to determine how tariffs are set and who is hired and who is fired and who gets water and who does not get water. This work we're going to do is a huge work, and we have to start it cautiously and carefully and gradually, make it public also through medias like yours.
Yes, it's
get people educated about the alternatives, and we think that alternative media like your media houses are the only ones that can give us spaces to push this kind of ideas.
It's a privilege for us to broadcast your message, Alhassan Adam. Alhassan Adam is from Ghana's Coalition Against the Privatisation of Water. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
New Internationalist's Jess Wirth has been exploring a range of world issues taking centre stage at this year's World Social Forum. What are the major issues that people are working on, Jess?
One of the most striking things has been the number of people who are working on extractive industries, you know, mining, coal, oil, gold, silver, gems, etc. There are just so many stories of terrible, terrible impacts on local communities as largely Western mining companies come in, throw them off their land, destroy their environment. They don't have any rights. None of the profit goes back into the community or the country. So this is a really huge issue. The next issue is EPAs. This is the new free trade agreement that is being resisted. It's economic partnership agreements, and it's between the European Union and Africa. And there are so many African groups from all over Africa who are resisting EPAs, saying that they don't want another free trade agreement. It's not in their interest.
Could I just ask, Jess, how does it differ in shape and substance to past agreements that have been struck in Africa between Europe and African countries?
I think what's happening is because World Trade Organization rules have now come into force, the original preferential trading agreements that Europe had with a lot of African countries because they were ex-colonies are now becoming illegal under WTO rules, and African countries benefited fairly well from those agreements. So what's happening now is that they're having to renegotiate those agreements along much more kind of neoliberal, complete open markets lines, and they're going to be thrown into much more into the global market in competition with other countries. And they feel that given that they have such a small portion of world trade at the moment anyway, that's not in their interest. But also, people are keenly aware of the impact that free trade rules have already had on their security, on their jobs, on their ability to farm and hold on to their land, and they just see this as being more of the same.
Your description about the issues surrounding extractive resources, minerals and oil and gas, I mean, it's almost like imperialism without the guns, isn't it? The money
people,
instead of
yeah,
the guns.
Yeah, people are talking about the new scramble for Africa, and I think that's how it feels for people. Like, just in the last few years, all of a sudden, the fact that Africa is very rich in natural resources has become hugely commercially interesting to mining companies around the world, and the continent's being carved up.
And instead of actually sending in the army, sending in the guns and holding people down that way, they're doing it with money and investment.
Yeah, absolutely. But the impact is very similar on poor people.
I'm Chris Richards, and you're listening to New Internationalist, coming to you live from this year's World Social Forum, the 7th, but the first to be held in Africa. The forum's being held in a stadium built by the Chinese in 1987 for the 4th All-African Games. The Chinese-built stadium is symbolic of China's increasing dominance in Africa. Last year was the 50th anniversary of the establishment of the first diplomatic ties between China and African countries. In June last year, Chinese President Hu Jintao and Premier Wen Xiaobo visited 10 African countries promoting the China-Africa connection. In November, African heads of state met in Beijing to learn of a massive Chinese package of aid and assistance, including preferential loans, cancellation of debts, and numerous other initiatives. China's motives are being questioned. Some say China are the new imperialists in Africa, using money to colonise rather than guns. Others say that China is only interested in Africa's resources and access to oil and gas fields. Yet others say that China is just forming international friendships that the Western world won't provide. New Internationalist's Jess Worth has been following the connections. What do you reckon, Jess?
Because over the last couple of years, China has been investing so heavily in Africa and has just signed a deal to give several billion dollars worth of aid to Africa as well. China has suddenly become a big player. People are very worried that they are becoming the new colonial masters. And just as countries are managing to break some of the chains of debt that have bound them to the West and the IMF and the World Bank, this new big player is coming in with no concern for human rights or the environment or local people, and is making deals with African governments all over the place. And there's really no control or no way of influencing them. And people feel that although China's investing a huge amount in Africa, again, the profits from that don't trickle down to local people, because China actually brings its own workers in. A lot of the big projects that it's funding are actually built by slave labour. They're built by Chinese prisoners who they bring over here. So it's not really benefiting ordinary African people at all.
I saw that in December, the South African president, Thabo Mbeki, warned African governments to be wary of sinking into a colonial relationship with China. At that stage, surveys coming out were indicating that China had overtaken Britain to become Africa's third most important trading partner after the US and France. And I thought it was interesting last September too, because China threatened to pull its investments out of Zambia during that country's presidential election. And I understand that was because Michael Sata, who was one of the presidential candidates, had met with Taiwanese officials. China, of course, is claiming Taiwan as part of China and accused Sata of an anti-Chinese stance and was very proactive in that, actually yelled loud and clear during that election that it would pull out its investments of Zambia if Sata won. So they're not being quiet about their actual presence and their investments in Africa either, Jess.
They're not, and Sudan is a really good case in point. China gets 5% of its oil from Sudan and sells the Sudanese government a lot of guns and weapons as well, which the Sudanese government is using on the people in Darfur. And the UN has been trying to pass resolutions to send peacekeeping troops in, but China has been blocking it on the Security Council because China's supporting the Sudanese government because they have such a lucrative commercial relationship with them. So it's definitely become a significant political actor and actually a really big problem for people who are campaigning for human rights.
That's an interesting development too. Instead of sending in, the old way would have been to send in China's troops and China's guns and actually kill the people themselves. Now they sell them to the governments. It's a win-win situation for them, isn't it? Jess, well, look, thanks very much for joining us today. Enjoy the World Social Forum. I understand, actually, that you're joining us for a program on ethical shopping. So we'll look forward to talking to you again then. Okay, well, that's it from today's New Internationalist. Join us same time, same place on the dial next week when campaigners from India, Fiji, England and New Zealand are planning to drop in for a chat. Thanks as always must go to New Internationalist producer Rachel Maher, and the music that we've been playing tonight. Well, it comes from the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. In the coming weeks, we'll be featuring albums from their Riverboat Records series, a different album every week. You'll find them on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. You'll also find copies of this program on the New Internationalist website, just waiting to be downloaded onto a computer or iPod near you. That's www.newint.org. I'm Chris Richards. Let's talk again soon.